This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. Please include this license notice with any copy or derivative of this work.
Recorded on Wednesday, May the 27th, 2009, this is Dan Lockton's talk, Design with Intent, How Designers Can Influence Behaviour.
Thanks, James, and thanks to Ben for a very interesting talk just now. I mean, I suppose what I'm doing is kind of looking at behaviour change a bit more broadly. So we're still looking at environmental stuff, but it's a bit more broadly based than that. It's kind of looking at a lot wider range of strategies, if you like. So I'm a PhD student at Brunel University in Uxbridge in Middlesex. So I'm in my second year at present, and so what I'm going to be talking about is design with intent. So it's basically how designers can influence behaviour. Now everything around us, whether it's been designed or not, necessarily influences our behaviour, right? So in one way or another. But many designers don't really appreciate quite how much power they've got in this plane. We often come across this sort of design in quite a negative or an irritating or even kind of evil context. So things like, you know, airport seats that are so uncomfortable that you can't lie down on them, hence people lie down on the floor when they need a rest. Or license agreements are presented in a way that's, whether it's by design or not, it's too difficult for you really to understand it or comprehend it in any way. So it's not user-friendly. It's basically an anti-user kind of thing, but it does influence your behaviour because, first of all, there's only an OK button. Right, you can't decline. I suppose you can close it, but
it's say no.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing's set up so that they get agreement with you, although it's not really agreement in any real sense. Things like the disabled fast forward control during, you're just trying to watch a DVD that you paid for, and so on. This sort of thing. We come across these sort of examples of design being used to influence our behaviour. It's generally quite negative. It's generally quite anti-user, in fact. It's serving someone else's agenda rather than being really user-centred. But design can be used to influence our own behaviour in a more positive way, right? It can help us to use things in a way which either helps us be more productive or helps us be more effective, or even, though it's kind of controversial, help us make better choices where we're perhaps not very good at making choices. I mean, it's controversial, it's the idea of the book, book Nudge, which Ben mentioned earlier, which has become quite sort of famous in political, sort of new political circles as being something, the idea of like libertarian paternalism, where we can tell the public what they need, but we'll present it as being kind of libertarian, because we give them a choice, but we make it very evident which one they should choose. So it's got some controversy behind it, but I do believe that as part of a general kind of user experience thing or even a usability kind of strategy, we can help people make better choices or use things in more effective ways. And it can help users themselves and it can help society as a whole. So our research at Brunel is specifically focused on influencing more sustainable user behaviour. So it's reducing the environmental impact of product use, which is to a large extent an interaction design problem, really. And much of what we're trying to do, though, ought to be applicable to lots of areas where influencing behaviour is important. Because, I mean, there's not... I don't think there's anything particularly special about sustainability or environmentalism. It's not... The actual behaviours that are required are just like anything else. It's just, you want someone to use something in the most efficient way. It's just like using something in the quickest way or using something in the optimised way for the amount of money it's going to cost you or something. It's not necessarily anything special, but it's often dressed up as a kind of special subject, but I don't think it is really. Mm-hmm. So why is it important, though? Well, for lots of products and services and systems, really, nowadays, the use phase is the most important in terms of the resources consumed and the waste generated. We can reduce the manufacturing energy required, we can reduce the disposal energy required when we recycle things and reuse them, but for lots of things, the use phase is the biggest component. And it's kind of determined by the product's efficiency in the first place and actually how people use it. And the user behaviour phase is kind of, it's a mixture of decisions and lack of decisions. So, we do things. We buy energy-saving fluorescent light bulbs and then leave them on all night. Or, you know, we kind of stick with the default setting on the washing machines. We're afraid to investigate, you know, this eco setting. What, you know, what if it doesn't wash the clothes properly? Too much hassle, you know? It's a kind of lack of decision. We leave the tap running while we brush our teeth. I mean, right, hands up who does this or who knows someone who does it. Okay, so it's a, I mean, all right, it's, you know, it's a reasonable portion of people, right? And it doesn't offer us any benefit other than a very small small kind of interaction challenge. So, I mean, this is actually one of the biggest problems in, well, it's not one of the biggest problems overall, but it's a dramatic problem. We put more water in the kettle than we need. We boil the whole kettle full. We just fill it up. Oh, that looks about right. And it's actually the amount of energy wasted from unnecessary overfilling kettles in the UK is 1.27 terawatt hours, which is enough energy or enough electricity to run practically all the street lights in the UK. That's just from unnecessary overfilling. Like, that's not people who need two mugfuls of hot water. That's people who need one mugful and fill the whole thing up. So, basically, all these lights could be powered by what we waste by something which offers us no benefit. You know, something that takes longer to boil, in fact. So there's got to be something that design can do here. It is really a design problem, because people don't want to be stupid. I mean, they might be stupid, but they don't want to be. It's not offering any benefit. And unfortunately, when it's scaled up across all the kind of household products which use energy, it's quite a big problem. 26 to 36% of household energy use is determined by behavioural decisions at the point of use. So I know you could argue that all of it's really determined by behavioural decisions. You know, you choose to live in a house that's badly insulated, or we don't choose to insulate it. But actually, at the point of use, things like, boiling too much water in the kettle, or, you know, running a washing machine on a setting higher than it needs to be. So that could be quite a big cost saving for people as well. So, what can you do about it? Governments generally try sort of social marketing campaigns. So we try and get people to think about, you know, CO2 and their carbon footprint and so on. You know, they work to some extent. But as a designer, I'd like to think that actually the design of the systems around us could be improved and could address this quite a lot. And you know, this is something that something that Ben kind of mentioned. Part of the problem really is that users' understanding of energy isn't great. There isn't yet much of a sort of ability to know what something is going to cost you or what the impact of doing something is going to be when you're using a device or, you know, turning it on or choosing not to turn it off or whatever. And this is the idea that, like, feed forward is important as well as feedback. So, I mean, Onzo is going to give people great feedback on what they're doing. But the idea of, like, having feed forward, that, you know, maybe if I choose to use this product, what's this about to cost me, or what's the energy impact going to be if I keep doing this every day for a month, or, you know, if I establish a habit of using this in this way, is this actually going to be good or bad or better or worse and other things? It's all, I mean, that's a, you know, just sticking a price label on the switch is, you know, it's a crude way of illustrating it, but is that sort of idea. And this is really where the idea of, like, supply and demand that's used in kind of, you know, we have supply and demand with sort of, you know, conventional products, like mobile phones or biscuits or moat cleaning services. You know, that sort of thing is like, you know, the price changes to match the demand because, you know, whatever. But with demand for energy in products, people don't necessarily know what it's going to cost them to do it. You don't necessarily make a choice to turn on the fridge or leave the fridge on the setting, colder setting you need or warmer setting you need. Yet it still counts as energy demand, even though the user or the customer hasn't really made an informed choice, just because you don't know what you're doing. It'd be like going into a shop and not understanding pricing, just going, oh, well, you know, I like this product, or I think I need some of that, so I'll sweep a load of it into the basket. It's almost on that level. We really don't have a good link between our understanding of what something's going to cost us, or the environmental impact of it, and what we do. So, you know, design ought to be able to improve this, basically is what I'm saying. But, you know, giving people immediate feedback is one thing, but there's lots of ideas of sort of social norms and so on. You know, what is the normal amount of energy to be using for this? Or am I doing better or worse? Which I mean, again, Alonzo's web, the web aspect of that will certainly give people that, so it should, that should be a great thing. But it takes us into areas of psychology, basically, which is something that, I mean, I suppose human-computer interaction designers who specialise in that know a lot more about it. But most designers haven't really learned too much about psychology. And, you know, it's an intersection of lots of fields, this area. There's you know, various branches of psychology, ecological psychology, there's environmental psychology, gestalt psychology, human-computer interaction, all of that, cognitive psychology, behavioural economics. There's loads of areas which any designer... How do we simplify all this into a form which is actually useful for people working in the field? And that's sort of what I'm trying to do. As an example, though, imagine you work for a design consultancy, which a lot of you do, and you were asked, I mean, perhaps a service design consultancy maybe, and you were asked to come and to try and, you know, improve the household thermostat, or improve central heating. How are you going to do it? What level can you address it at that will influence user behaviour? Is it going to be something actually at the level of the interface? Is it going to be making the timer or the thermostat better in some way, easier for the user to understand? Or is it going to be something behind the scenes? And, you know, do we actually need to change the way the whole thing works? Or is it going to be at a higher level, like sort of social networks within a house? Or, you know, do we get people to influence each other? Or if people say whether they're hot, too hot or too cold, and some level of that kind of interaction with it. And we don't know. Right? There is no obvious solution to it, because there hasn't been enough sort of empirical data in this area. There haven't been enough companies who've tried it out, because it's a massive risk to try and influence people's consumers' behaviour, because they might turn away and never buy the product again. So it's something that, yeah, that it's difficult for designers to know where to go. And it's also difficult from a user-centred design point of view. If you're actually trying to change the way people use something rather than just kind of accommodate it, is that still user-centred design? Or is that actually venturing into a kind of being evil in a way that, you know, at least as it can be presented by some people? I don't know. It's something that needs sorting out. So what I've been trying to do is almost produce a kind of set of design patterns of where design has been used to influence behaviour in lots of different fields. So stuff from architecture and computer science and interaction design and various other parts of psychology and so on, to try and at least give designers somewhere to start almost with some level of evidence, or at least examples of where it's been applied and whether these things can be applied in different contexts. So, yeah, I mean, eventually it will end up something like, perhaps, like, kind of idea of method cards or something, but a bit more structured, maybe. Hopefully, that's part of the plan, anyway. So, what we call it is design with intent. As a broad category, this is design across any field which is intended to influence or result in certain user behaviour. It sort of makes sense to think about it in... Well, I mean, there are lots of ways you could divide it up, but these approaches almost have come through quite strongly. There are approaches where you try and motivate people, which is that you kind of try and get them to change their attitudes or change the reasoning behind why they do something. So they think about it and say, oh, actually, I want to change my behaviour to be like this, and I'm going to do it. So things like, I would argue that things like energy meters or energy displays are trying to get people to think about what they're doing and how changes they're using, with the hope that they'll change their behaviour afterwards. So this is one approach. And lots of the work in persuasive technology that's come out of Stanford in particular is in this field. So it's getting people to change their attitude, and then their behaviour will hopefully change as a result. But arguably, there's quite a lot of possibility in simply enabling certain behaviours, making it easier to do one thing and to do the other. So something like this is the eco button, which is a one-touch button which puts a laptop or a computer in standby mode. Now, I know you can argue that your laptop's already got that button, but a lot of people don't use it, or they don't understand how to use it, or they work in an office where, I don't know, the administrator has set it up so it doesn't work properly, or however. But this is something where a single button with one press, when you go to lunch, you press it in standby mode, that's it. You know that it's the most... It's easier to do that than to click start and shut down and the rest of it. That's the company's aim behind it anyway, is to make it easier to save energy than not to save energy. And it does give you feedback and your boss feedback on how much energy you've saved by doing it. So it's got a kind of motivating aspect as well. This is the enabling thing is really what Buck means to Fuller. Kind of, this was his sort of attitude to how environmental, well, better environmental behaviour could. But it goes, sorry, it's low down in that. Sorry, it's not very well designed. But you know, his argument really was that, you know, reforming man is too difficult. We can't necessarily really change what people think or on a large scale. But what we can do is we can modify the environment so as to get people moving in preferred directions. So it's sort of, I don't know, it's the approach I prefer, but I understand why others are important. Unfortunately, going back to things like the airport benches and so on, constraining behaviour is often the approach taken by governments. It's saying, well, you know, we want to constrain people to particular kinds of behaviour we deem acceptable. And there's lots of design that uses this approach. These benches were installed in Oxford City Centre. They cost £8,000 each. They're deliberately high enough off the ground so that you can't sit on them without your feet resting on the ground continuously. So you basically can just perch on them. You can't lie down on them, you can't lean back any more than a particular angle and so on. They were designed so people wouldn't loiter, they wouldn't sit for too long. If they were going to sit, they'd go in a cafe and that sort of thing. But it's a good lesson, because that might have been the designer's intent behind it, but in fact that's what happens when people come to use it. The street finds its own uses for things, and I think this is the constraining behaviour sort of approach isn't really going to work. You know, we could be rationing electricity, and it may come to that in some areas, but it's not as a strategy for getting people to change voluntarily. It's unlikely to work with a lot of other consumers. People react. There's what, you know, psychological reactance to feeling that you're being constrained or controlled by something. And it's, you know, it's quite easy to parody this kind of thing. This is from Beta a few months ago. But I mean, the fact that someone thought of that means that, you know, this idea is already in people's heads, right? That design can be used to constrain people, and, you know, and that there probably are sort of non-user-centered motives behind a lot of it. This is Sarah Ross, who's an artist, has built arranging these arky suits, as you call them, which are basically they're padded suits that enable you to lie down on benches that have got armrests strategically placed to stop you doing it. It's an extreme example, but the very fact that people feel the need to do it means that basically the constraining approach is unlikely to be successful, except in certain areas. Now it's interesting to think that something like a microwave oven door, the interlock on it, you can't operate a microwave oven with the door open, but you don't mind that. And there's no people campaigning against that and, you know, disabling it because, oh, I can't have this thing controlling it, because it doesn't seem to be inconveniencing you or removing anything that you had before. Yeah, so.
Another example is like Lego, which wouldn't work without constraints at all.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah,
so in some contexts it can work really, really well. But
yeah, where it offers the user a benefit. Because if Lego wasn't interoperable, it wouldn't. Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, so there are areas where constraining it, when it's in the user's interest, it probably, and the user doesn't see it as being constraining
against.
It's probably, you know, it can work, but I don't know how we can apply that to the sort of energy and environmental things. There could be some areas where it may work.
You take everyone for example. I mean, part of the problem there is that most people, it's not designed, so you just add a cup. You wouldn't really want to have a red cup, red cup, red cup. Because I mean, most people, the thing about doing red cups, it takes a long time to boil. Most people don't like that.
So it's in their interest, so it's strange.
Yes, it's not that they don't want it, it's just the design is stupid.
Well, that is a good point. I mean, that's something I'll come back to it with the kettle design in a bit. But no, you are right, that approach may well work when it's right, when it's clearly aligned with what you want as a user. You don't see it as restricting. So maybe I should qualify. It's where someone sees it as being restrictive, that it's less likely to work, perhaps, or at least likely to cause some sort of reactance. I mean, these are a couple of quotes about this idea of technology or products or design which confronts. I mean, Ted Nelson, you can argue that maybe he's a bit paranoid about it, but he he saw a lot of things as being almost technology as something which he was forcing people to submit to. Because of the rules that exist, you have to use things in a particular way, whatever. Whereas, I mean, Cory Doctorow put it simply that where there's still a market choice, where a customer can choose between different products, they're not likely to choose the one which constrains them unnecessarily, unless they're uninformed about it, perhaps, which may be another note. But they're interesting views on the constraining. There aren't too many views on, or at least not too many sort of memorable quotes on the other areas, which is interesting, because it hasn't been seen in that way necessarily yet. And from a sort of systems thinking point of view, it's probably difficult to read that, but it's Donella Meadows, who is one of the authors of Limits to Growth, which was a kind of quite oppressive report in the 70s about whether the world economy could keep growing and why. Like she argued that there are lots of kind of levels at which you can intervene in any system. And probably the ones that are most relevant to designers are things about kind of designing the structure of systems, whether they can evolve themselves or whether kind of like users can add or change them. Any sort of constraints and incentives that are built into a system. And also, most importantly, from a sort of interaction design point of view, probably the structure of information flows. Who has access to the information? If we have amazing APIs on energy meters which allow people to find interesting things out about data, the patterns in it and so on, it could lead to mass behaviour change if people suddenly realise they're doing something very strange or that everyone else does something very different. And, I never realised you have to close the door on the fridge. That kind of, it's almost, the ability to have that information is very important. Or it could be, at least. So the system thinking thing, I mean, it has been kind of hyped, but it is important in this area. So things like, if you're designing a stadium like that, you need to consider the broader context of I mean, this sort of thing, it's a trite example, but it's a point of, we need to consider what context these things are really being used in. Any behaviour change thing could easily fall by the wayside if some major change occurs in society or technology change, which means that it's something where you're becoming more efficient using your compact fluorescent bulbs is relevant if everyone's moving to LED lighting and it's so is that sort of system level thing which is important to bear in mind. So anyway, the sort of set of design patterns that I've been trying to extract from examples from those different fields, it sort of fits into six different lenses, which we call them lenses, because they're almost like you're looking at the same thing but with a different sort of perspective. Because a lot of them are really talking about the same sort of stuff, it's just that they're almost worldviews from different disciplines or different kind of academic fields. Now the persuasive lens is like I was mentioning earlier, the persuasive technology group at Stanford and the researchers just come out of that, says, well, we really need to kind of get people to change their attitudes and they will hopefully change their behaviours as a result. And some of the major sort of design patterns in this are things like self-monitoring, which is, it's kind of the principal thing, really, giving people more information about the impact of their actions. But there's also things like Kairos here, which means, it's always the opportune moment to give someone some information. So the speed things which flash up your speed at a point when it's ideal for you to change it, it's the right moment to tell you. If you tell someone half a mile in advance, they perhaps won't slow down as much as if they suddenly get a thing flashing up. Now, I know there's a risk of overkill with it, and in fact, it's probably now people are used to it and it doesn't have as much impact, but at the point they were introduced, it did have a big effect. Volvo in the 1980s used to offer a gear change suggestion log, which was a very simple thing. It monitored the engine RPM and the throttle position and said, well, you should change gear now. And it didn't force you to change gear, but it was the right moment to tell you that it would be more efficient if you changed gear. And I don't know whether drivers appreciate it or not. I mean, my dad just used to ignore it. It was like, oh, bloody light, I don't have a knack telling me what to do. But, it's there, right? It's a kind of, it's a technique. So There are other patterns as well. I probably won't have time to go through them in detail, but I mean, there are lots of kind of patterns in this area. A cognitive approach looks at things like social proof. So what do other users like me do in this situation? And again, it's sort of, you know, it can be things where you aspire to join a group, as well as just saying what people like me use. You know, am I using more electricity than my neighbours? It can be like, well, am I being less efficient than people I want to be like? Which, you know, is a subtle difference, but it's behind a lot of the, it's a mechanism behind a lot of the growth of things on Facebook and so on. A lot of applications are things like, well, that person's cool, I want to be like that person, they've added that application, therefore I should. I mean, I don't know whether it's whether the long-term effect is valid or not, but certainly in the short term, it seems to be behind a lot of things on lot of the effect. Framing as a psychological technique is obvious. It's things like framing energy saving as being saving you money rather than saving the planet, which for, you know, for a lot of users and a lot of consumers is probably actually what they want to hear. I mean, examples here, Starbucks menu, you know, doesn't give you the price for the small and short option, which, you know, is available, you can ask for it, but it's framed in a way that the smallest one they offer is called tall, so it makes everything seem bigger. You know, it's a subtle thing, and whether it really has any effect on sales, I don't know, but they've stuck with it, which is interesting. The other example is the knock-off Nigel campaign, is sort of framing, like, you know, copying DVDs or copying movies as being in the same bracket as, like, theft of money from a friend or something, which is interesting. They've categorised them, they've lumped them together as being the same sort of thing, and then to try and get people to think of them as being the same sort of thing. You could apply that technique in other ways to try and get people to think of energy saving as being, you know, friendly or happy or a good thing to do. Well, yeah, it's sort of quite woolly, really, but it's, you know, as a technique, it exists. Error-proofing is probably something that most interaction designers and kind of HCI people are probably most familiar with from this sort of Don Norman approach, where, you know, it seems like, well, choose sensible defaults. So if the default setting on a washing machine was the most efficient, or if the default setting on the printer was draft quality, because most people leave things on the default setting, you probably have a big impact on their behaviour without even knowing, without even realising or thinking about it. The example of the donor card is that, you know, in countries where presumed consent is the default, so if you have a donor card, an opt-out donor card, if you don't want your organs to be donated, it seems to be evidence that the level of people opting out is much lower than people who don't have it in the UK, for example. So that there's a kind of balance there which perhaps could be exploited or used or applied in other situations. Things like interlocks are, you know, we mentioned earlier with the microwave oven, but I mean stuff like, you know, getting people so that they do things in the right order, perhaps the most efficient order, could be something that's just designed into a system without people thinking, but it still alters their behaviour even though they don't necessarily think about it. Architectural approaches are often, yeah, I mean, these are physical examples from things like, you know, that's a like material properties there. This is a cycle path in Finland where, to distinguish between the cycle bit and the pedestrians, there's simply a line of rougher paving between the two. So it's not a big line painted or anything, and it doesn't stop a cyclist going onto the pedestrian bit. It's just a kind of gentle reminder that you're on the wrong bit because you get a rough sort of feeling. But a lot of these architectural techniques are almost to be applied, if you think of them as being about like the structure of systems rather than necessarily the built environment, they can apply to, well, anything that's a system that's designed. I mean, the way you lay out, I mean, maybe the website's a kind of obvious example, but I mean, even things like the segmentation of something into multiple elements, so one person can't dominate all of them, or one user can't use them all at once, or someone who's kind of has to go through different steps. You know, it's applied in architecture by breaking up, separating things like ATMs. You make them further apart so that people don't feel intimidated standing there. You know, if they're too close together, people wait until everyone's gone before using them. The same with the riots, to be honest. It's that kind of thing. You can apply that idea in lots of contexts. You know, if you break some website process up into multiple elements, you know, you can, first of all, it gives you various advantages in terms of influencing people's behaviour. You can get them so they see it as less of a massive task, because it seems to be sort of bite-sized chunks, or you can do it so that multiple people can be using different bits each time. So,
Do you mind getting interrupted?
Yeah, no, I don't mind.
So, talking about cash machines, you know, there's something like yellow boxes have started appearing on the pavement around cash machines with stripes in them, which I think is really clever. But would you class that as an architectural thing, or is that more of a cognitive and sort of social thing?
That's a good question. I suppose if it's done in a, when we'll get on this, the visual kind of approach. So if you think about it as being the fact that it's coloured is almost like it's a kind of obviously contrasting vector. So I mean that would be like this idea of kind of colour and contrast. If you make something obviously different or obviously stand out in some way, then it will change the way people see it. And it's interesting that it's yellow and it isn't like, I don't know, sort of happy green colour. It's a kind of danger, keep out of this zone sort of thing. That means a good point. What I should say, these sort of patterns, is they're not exclusive of each other. In fact, most examples really employ more than one of them, or at least you can think about it in multiple ways. It's just these are the kind of ways that people from different fields might consider it. So a graphic designer might think of it, may think of it in terms of these things, whereas an architect might see it as being segmenting. Do you see what I mean? Like it's kind of, in fact, most examples really use multiple patterns in it. They're kind of way of getting started in this. Yes, I mean, these are some of the kind of visual sort of approaches to it. I mean, metaphors are an obvious one. I'll get onto this forward efficiency needs display in a minute, but it's, you know, obviously dangers with metaphors that if you're trying to make some people think that it's like something that they already know, but in fact it's not really like that, then people may continue using it in the wrong way. Or you know, there are dangers where they start to break down, where in fact it's worse for the user. Because, I don't know, example, say someone believes that they have to delete the file, they have to take it to the recycle bin, and then they have to empty the recycle bin separately, because the metaphor of how the bin works is ingrained in one. You know, it may actually be more productive to delete the thing immediately.
His daughter had a vlogger that she got to work on. And he came back from just sitting there, like, mischievously moving everything to the left hand side. Okay. What were you doing? He didn't have enough space on it.
Right.
And it was the space, he was making more space for the new file.
Right, well, that's fantastic. That's a brilliant example, isn't it? It's something where people think that it's like, yeah, because it's the metaphor is kind of.
It's perfect sense in terms of space.
That's a good, I like that. there's obviously a danger then where if we build fantastic metaphors, say we say that, I don't know, we portray energy as being like water or something, or we have a display that has like, you know, energy dripping away as we're using things, people may start thinking of it in the same way, and they may, I don't know what the bad consequence of that would be, but there are obviously things where when the metaphor breaks down, it can cause actually problems like that, or at least inefficient ways of doing things, which is, I don't know, things like people going around turning all the sockets off because they think the electricity was leaking out. You know, that sort of, if we use metaphors too much, or the wrong metaphors, they can actually be counterproductive. There's obviously warnings with each of these, or kind of caveats, but they're just kind of different ways of approaching influencing behaviour. And this is the security lens, so the sort of security approach, a lot of it is about surveillance, so it's kind of even the threat of surveillance. So people think that their behaviour is being observed or monitored, or you know, perhaps uploaded to some website where, you know, other people can look at it, whether it's the electricity company or whether it's, you know, the government or whoever. That, you know, it can be used to affect people's behaviour and influence it, but it can also lead to quite a lot of sort of a lack of trust and a sort of lack of, you know, people don't know what's going to happen to it, or they don't know who's watching, and you know, so there are dangers of that. I don't really think these approaches are necessarily as they're not very user friendly, but in some circumstances they can, you know, they can certainly work. The atmospheric things here are things like putting blue lighting in public toilets to try and stop people injecting into their vein, because then it's more difficult to see it. But it kind of just moves the problem elsewhere.
There's also a problem with time with some of these as well. For example, the surveillance ones, the one that's a good surveillance camera, prime cease this for about 3 or 4 months, and it just goes back to what it was before. The fresh bread thing, in my experience, is smelling fresh bread in the supermarket, it's mostly made the supermarket bread, which is rubbish.
Right.
And it doesn't spend less time there.
That's interesting. There's that's an interesting effect. So it's a kind of, it becomes too, it no longer has the desired effect because it's become, you've already been able to associate something with it. Mm-hmm. Like if it was a completely new thing, it may be, you know, it might influence the first time you smelt it, it might work, but then after that you realise that it's actually not very good. And so I mean, you're right, there's a lot of disadvantages to all of these. And perhaps with the surveillance, the lack of feedback loop, but you can't, unless you can see who's watching you, you don't actually know whether there's anyone watching you. So yeah, after a few months of no action seemingly being taken or whatever, you know, it becomes just another part of the street furniture without anyone noticing it. So these are some of the different approaches. There's a lot of them. There's almost 50 in total, but there were 50 sort of patterns or techniques that I've managed to identify. And there are others. It's just slicing them up in a way that kind of makes sense to designers quickly is probably the main aim behind it, really. So it's something that you can use at the kind of concept generation stage and say, well, you know, if we combine this idea with this idea, what how could that apply? And that's the sort of approach. So they fit together into this sort of toolkit thing, which you can download it. It's all like Creative Commons license, because to be honest, the more people who read it and point out mistakes or better examples or things that I've missed out, the better, really. But I mean, just to go back to the point of some of the things incorporating more than one technique. So this is, Ford have introduced this sort of energy meter thing on the dashboard, or fuel gauge, which it basically gives you, the amount of leaves and the vines, change depending on how efficiently you're driving and so on. So it kind of, this combines like a metaphor, which I don't know whether it's a good metaphor or not, but the tree and the leaves and so on, and a kind of Kairos thing, like it's the right time to tell you to change how you're driving because you're actually in a position to do something about it. Whereas an electricity bill that comes, every quarter and tells you need to use less electricity is probably the wrong time because it's so far divorced from when you've actually made the decisions or the lack of decisions. It's kind of, there's a disconnect there. Something like Amazon's, customers who bought this item also bought these, it's got a sort of social proof element to it, because it's saying you want to be like these people or these people are like you on some level. But again, it's also exactly the right moment, at least from Amazon's point of view, to tell you that you might be interested in them, because you're already in a frame of mind where you're buying stuff. You've already committed to buying one book, so you're probably in a good position to buy others. So this is, again, so that combines at least two kind of patterns, and in fact most of the examples do, really.
Could you not also see that last one as providing the return of parts? So you might decide to look at it, but should be using it in the fire. But you've already committed to one of the passing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And there might be similarities between the other stuff.
Yeah, that is true. So you're kind of being provided with a way out, which according to what Amazon wants, rather than the way out which they don't want, which is that you close the tab and... Yeah, that's a good point. It's almost then, a lot of the kind of patterns or the techniques are almost, they really are kind of simply how you think about it. If you see it like that, it may still cause you to come up with that idea. It'd be like, that may still lead to that idea, but it's... So they're almost... I don't know whether they're called design patterns or not, really, because they're not patterns in the classical sense. They're sort of almost inspiration points or something, sort of proto-patterns. I don't know. I'm not quite sure what the terminology should be. How long is the time?
You have 5 minutes.
Right.
To half past.
Okay, thanks. Well, we've run trials of this sort of toolkit with design students mostly so far. I mean, some designers with a couple of years' experience, mostly product designers, applying it to briefs like this sort of thing. So getting people to use less or to think more about home lighting, like turn the lights off and so on. The sort of ideas that the trials have only been quite small so far, but it shows some effect. People who have this method or this set of patterns or ideas come up with slightly more ideas than people who don't have any method at all or any inspiration, and they come up with more diverse ideas. But it tends to be, if you don't have any kind of stimulus to it, you may come up with lots of ideas, but they're all based on a couple of kind of key things that you maybe were already thinking about. Whereas having these patterns certainly leads to a broader range of ideas, whether that's good or bad. I mean, it's good from the point of view of getting lots of concepts, but whether actually any of the concepts are any good is another matter. So we need, when we applied that the stuff to that brief, we came up with the participants came up with ideas like, I mean, things like, well, you can see it there, but things like improving the prominence of light switches or kind of, you know, sort of changing the defaults. So, I mean, that's quite a sort of authoritarian one. People have to justify why they need the lights on before. You know, this. I mean, these are ideas that you know, the design students have come up with, and, yeah, I mean, some of them could probably work. Certainly things like feedback, sort of self-monitoring on, you know, how well your lighting compares to other houses in the street, which maybe you can see it might anyway, but even like some sort of display that shows you, you know, how much you compare to your neighbours. Some of them are interesting ideas, like getting children more interested, like having sort of emoticons or some sort of extra experience to a light switch, some sort of kind of affective engagement with it. So you know how like they sell those the glow-in-the-dark stars to encourage children to sleep when they're scared of the dark, you know, so it makes it kind of exciting to have the lights on. Maybe, you know, there's a way of incorporating something like that into a light switch or something, so it actually becomes exciting when it's off rather than it's boring when it's off. I mean, those are, you know, some of the sort of ideas.
Dan, there was you talked about the greener gadgets earlier.
Yeah.
There was the piggyback that kids could plug in to tell them how they had to basically put enough money in to work their laptop.
Yes.
That amount of time, so I guess that's...
Yes, okay, so it gives a kind of direct... It exposes a kind of link between behaviour and... Yeah, reward.
People make a stand by and make things they look like angry red lights.
Yes, yeah, that was a good thing. That was a great entry.
There's quite a lot of proposals to make lights which is harder to turn on when your house is consuming more power.
Okay, that's interesting.
So you probably have turned on the hunger is
that's interesting. Yeah, but I mean that, you know, sorry. I mean, that sort of thing, but it's whether, and I suppose there's always a point, would anyone buy it? And the point is probably, people might buy it as a crazy thing for the kids, or like a toy, but it's unlikely that people specify houses to, you know, to build it, which is always going to be an issue with this, which is...
You also get that from the summer days, where you've got the sensors to switch up, and you know, really, so you get that bizarre thing, and the children have to go...
Yeah. But this is the thing, if it becomes annoying like that, I mean, there are lots of cases when people are actually really annoyed by automatic lights that switch off when no one's moving, you know, or they can't, I don't know, there's implications for, if you've got a corridor where the lights, you have to switch them on and they automatically switch off every few seconds, like sort of some hotel corridors have that. I mean, if you're in a wheelchair, it can be quite difficult actually, it's possible to get stuck and you can't see where the light switches are because they're too far down the corridor. So there are kind of things where, you know, like, if it becomes too annoying or too irritating or just impossible for users actually to engage with it, it's not going to work in influencing behaviour, it's just going to piss people off.
The people in my flat have got one of those press button lights that kind of sort of pops out after sort of 5-6 seconds, and people jam paper in, stop it from popping out because it's irritating.
So it doesn't meet that, I mean, it really doesn't meet the needs of what the people who want to use it. It's like propping the fire door open with a fire extinguisher type, you know, it's kind of, it doesn't. When you see things like that happening, you know that the thing hasn't been designed really with actually looking at what the people who use it need or want, which is, it's a good way of revealing that, I guess.
Yeah, isn't there part of this one, for example, with the light thing, but often you don't actually know that the light upstairs is on, because you've left it without realising. And if you have something, you just hold it like that thing.
Yeah.
And you could switch it on without getting up from football or something.
Yeah, so some sort of remote controls, I mean, which obviously they do exist, but they perhaps don't exist so well, or they're not so common between floors, and something which actually shows you what's on at any one time. Yeah.
But the design time is there, it means you get personal information.
Mm. And how much, you know, is it going to become too sort of, it does it get to the point where people don't care about it anymore because it's just another display they've got to pay attention to, you know, how much money am I spending on this, how much. It's, yeah, it depends on sort of almost what's the most important thing to address. And, yeah.
Something that comes across, I guess it's sort of been there the whole time, but when you're talking about this, something that comes across is that you've got like the user to please, you've got the person who manufactures the theme to please, mm-hmm. you've got the environment that needs to be taken into account, you've got like people who build the houses, and you need solutions that are going to sort of make all of those different stakeholders simultaneously happy. And that's quite a tall order. But what you end up with is something that's really elegant and beautiful, in the same way that things in nature like have like fulfilled several needs simultaneously and elegantly and without lots of features. And I think that's a really important thing for designers to philosophical point.
Well, and it's probably true in that the simpler things are probably likely to be more effective, and adding an extra layers and layers of technology to everything to detect what's happening, is this in this position or that position, probably won't have the same effect as something really obvious and simple. Some of the simplest things, I haven't shown it in the talk, but things like, cigarette bins are often sold with an angled top on them because you can't put litter on it, or people are less likely to leave litter on it if the top isn't angled, because the moment they put it on it, it'll fall off. But that's something that costs no more to manufacture than a flat top. And yet the bins are actually sold on that basis. This angled top discourages litter. And I don't know if it really works, but the point is the manufacturer likes selling it like that. Councils and other authorities like buying it because of the angled top. And it's something that really didn't cost any more, which is an interesting sort of almost non-technological approach. But it is about design, because it is certainly about interaction design, because it's changing the way people perceive the affordance of what they can do with it.
The other thing is that you pay attention to how people behave, because it's sort of the assumption of like people use like things in the same way. But you think about this a lot, isn't it? One of the things I find is I go into a room and I've got that particular activity I was doing, and I have to turn the light off. So if I had like a second button, which I've just pressed, and the light stayed on while it was moving in the room, and then I can move the stuff.
That's
other people want it much of the time.
So almost adding an extra mode, like a kind of on or off or on for a while or on while I'm here.
And if you put it in a position where I can just hit it, that would probably be the one that I would use. And if I really just dying these really people instead of the lab, I think about it.
It's true. So it's almost like push button taps, when you have to hold it down, or it's got a spring so it goes back up again after a certain amount of time. Which doesn't necessarily, inconveniences people sometimes if they need a lot of water, but most of the time it doesn't. Mm. Interesting. Yeah, it's a good...
It's a common design mistake, but the mode is going to seem useful. It generally isn't.
Mm. The different use, the modes of use. Well, that's something that, we need to investigate with actual user studies, which is going to be... Sorry, those are some of the... A couple of sketches that participants did of some of the ideas. So, But going back to that point, when we actually get to doing the studies with users, we will try and really kind of almost code what different uses things are, what modes they're in. So they're probably going to be trials with kettles, because it's something that is cheap, they're cheap to buy and modify. So there'll be a range of different kettles, which will have each of which will incorporate one or more different design techniques to try and encourage people to use them, or influence people to use them in a more efficient way. So it might be things like, there may well be one which, does it cup by cup, and perhaps boils individual units of a particular amount of water, and maybe you can boil them simultaneously, if you've set, it doesn't have to be I suppose that will actually take the same amount of energy. But, there are lots of different ways it could be done. There may be ones, there are products on the market like this Eco Kettle where it has two chambers where you fill up one with water and you dispense water from one into the other. It's boiled in the other chamber. So you can still fill it up at the beginning of the day and just release water from one to the other when you need it. But the point is, the only people who are going to buy it are people who already care about that. So it doesn't really impact the kind of larger scale use in the way that it could do. It's not made by a major manufacturer. It costs 5 times what a kettle does from Tesco. So it's sort of kettles are probably going to be what we're going to try this coming summer and autumn, with different prototypes, and actually find out which techniques within this very limited use context really work and which ones don't. We can measure the energy use relatively easily compared to measuring other kinds of behaviour change, because we really can report how changes being used relative to baseline behaviour of what people do without this different petal. So, yeah, I won't go through all this, but I mean, there's a kind of an extra level of this method would be actually finding out which patterns work best for which types of behaviour that you're trying to achieve, which would be, you know, it's kind of a longer term goal of it. So you can classify behaviours into various kinds of types and try and work out which things work best. And a lot of environmental things are really about thinking to use things in a sort of optimised way for what they're doing at the time. You know, maybe that you can't necessarily just set a one size fits all thing, like all lights will switch off at 9 p.m. Not switch off, you know, whatever, you know, all lights will switch off when it's bright enough outside, isn't going to fit a lot of use cases where people need it for some reason. So it's when it's optimised for what they're actually doing. So anyway, this is kind of extra level, and it will turn into a kind of, hopefully at some point, turn into a system where there's a kind of mapping between different design techniques and patterns and actual behaviours. So, yeah, I mean, that's, I suppose the question I'd ask, I mean, we've kind of discussed it a bit, but is this sort of idea or method, do you think it's actually useful or not for designers, at least at the level it is now? And I suppose, you know, how do you come up with ideas like this without it? I mean, what sort of inspiration do you get? Where does it come from? You know, are examples better? Or, you know, what? It's kind of, I'm trying to find out really from a room full of designers how you would do it if you were asked to solve this sort of problem, or at least to address it. So anyway, yeah, well, thank you. Thanks for listening, and yeah, thanks for some great questions so far.